Okay, I'm ready.
So last week we began to look at Paul's address after he had spoken in the synagogue. There was a week where he spent his time teaching the city, and it was a combination of Jews and Gentile audience that was there. And we began to look at what it was that he was proclaiming. And we saw that Luke does record three of Paul's evangelistic messages in the book of Acts, Acts 13, Acts 14, and Acts 17 are where they all occurred. We saw this address here in Acts 13 is basically broken down into three sections. The first section was talking about the preparation of the coming of the Messiah, and that would be Acts 13, verses 16 through 25. The second section, which we're going to look at a little bit tonight, and then into the third section, really picks up, and the second section is Acts 13, verses 26 down through 37, or 27. And then the third section, I'm sorry, 37 is correct. Yeah, 37 is correct. Yeah. And the third section is Acts 13, verses 38 through 41. So I want to look at this second section tonight. But I want to, again, just a brief review on the preparation for the Messiah. Paul actually goes through Israel's history again. And he sounds a lot like Stephen in some things. You know, he gets into how Israel has only one Elohim.
Yes.
And that's a big issue. That Elohim was the Elohim of the fathers. He's the one who selected the fathers. He's the one who creates the nation, redeems his people out of the land of Egypt, and partially leads and patiently leads them through the wilderness. He's the one who gives Canaan as an inheritance to the nation of Israel. And then Elohim gave the nation its faithful sovereign of David and a succession of leaders that would come from David that would culminate in the ultimate successor, which would be Jesus. And we spent a little bit of time talking about the ramifications of Samuel to all of that. Now, I want to pick up here in verses 26 down through 37, and maybe we can just read around the room so it's on the tape. So I'll start here in verse 26. Men, brothers, sons of the ethnicity of Abraham, and the ones among you revering Elohim, the message of this deliverance has been apostolized to you.
For the people of Jerusalem and their rulers, by the judgment they pronounced on Jesus, have actually fulfilled the predications of the prophets, which are read Sabbath after Sabbath. Through ignorance of these predictions, and of him.
And though no cause of death was seen in him, they made a request of Pilate that he might be put to death.
And when they had fulfilled all that was written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a sepulchre.
But Elohim raised him from the dead.
For many days he was seen by those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now his witness to the people.
We are telling you the evangel, what Elohim promised our ancestors.
God has fulfilled the same unto us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus again, as it is also written in the second Psalm, "You are my son, this day have I begotten thee."
Elohim raised him from the dead, never to experience decay. As he said, "I will give you the holy promises made to David."
Therefore, he also says in another Psalm, "You will not permit your Holy One to experience decay."
For having served his own generation by the counsel of God, David truly fell asleep and was added to his ancestors and saw decay.
But he, whom God raised again, saw no corruption.
Okay. That's the section here that we're going to deal with. Now, really, what it's going to talk about is the death, burial, and resurrection.
Yeah.
And anybody who's a believer should be excited to talk about the death, burial, and resurrection, right? And I think it's a fascinating passage that Paul begins to lay out here. He's going to proceed to narrate the rejection, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus. Just like he says, and I think it's interesting the choice of words that Paul used in verse 32. "We are telling you the evangel." Where in 1 Corinthians 15, he refers to the evangel that he preached. That was a mystery, a secret. And what he was proclaiming was that Christ died for our sins, according to Scriptures, that he was buried, and then he rose again the third day, according to Scriptures. So he's going to actually go through the death, burial, and resurrection right here. That to me, whenever you get a chance to talk about those things, it's always an interesting thing. Now,
Bill, are you saying that in verse 32, Paul is referring to his evangel since he's now off to the Gentiles?
I don't think he's necessarily referencing it as solely his evangel, as much as what he's saying is that all of the promises that were given to Israel's ancestors are predicated upon what he's about to say.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's true, because if he stayed in the grave, then the promised successor of David could never come. So, in Israel's evangel is tied in with its covenants. So the very fact that Jesus has to be alive for those covenants to actually be in effect impacts how Israel's promises are understood. So that's a good question, though. So I think, again, when the Paul begins to speak here, he's going to begin with the innocence of Jesus. I think that's always an interesting place. Let me kind of come here in verse 27. "For the people of Jerusalem, and by their rulers, by the judgment they pronounced on Jesus, have actually fulfilled the predictions of the prophets, which are read Sabbath after Sabbath, through ignorance of those predictions of him," of those predictions and of him, because there's predictions, but they're also of him. "And though no cause of death was seen in him, they made a request to Pilate that he might be put to death."
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing here is there's these predictions in the Old Testament that speak of Jesus and him being rejected and crucified.
53:7.
Well, the most notable one, I would say, is Psalm 69.
Psalm 69.
Where it talks about and depicts a crucifixion. And it actually talks about it and depicts it some few hundred years before crucifixion actually ever took place. So I want to go to Psalm 69 for a second, just so we can see a little bit of the flow of this psalm. Okay, Psalm 69. And in this here, he gets into, let's look at, let's start here at verse, let's start at verse 7. Because for thy sake have I borne reproach. Confusion hath covered my face. One estranged have I become to my own brother, yea, an alien to the sons of mine own mother. Now he's talking here about the rejection of the nation and the fact that he now is viewed as an alien to his fellow Israelites. And not only to them, but to his siblings as well. And it's interesting he mentions his mother there. You know, he talks about humbling his soul with fasting in verse 10. Coming down, he gets into a discussion here. Let's come up to, say, verse 18, down through 21. O draw near unto my soul, redeem it, because of mine enemies, ransom me. Thou knowest my reproach and my shame and my confusion. Before thee are all mine adversaries. Reproach hath broken my heart, and I am weak. Though I waited for one to pity me, yet there was none. And for comforters, yet I found not any. But they put in my food poison. And for my thirst, they gave for my drink vinegar. Now, I want to look at that phraseology, for my food poison. I want to look at that for a second. If you go to Matthew 27, Matthew 27 and verse 34. They gave him to drink wine with gall mingled, and tasting he would not drink. Now, it's interesting. Gall was a type of a drug that sometimes could be used to allow a person to die quicker. It was very easy to give somebody an overdose of a medication that impacts your central nervous system to shut it down so that death ensues relatively painless. And the idea that seems to be conveyed by the psalmist that's confirmed by Matthew is that there were those that just looked at it and said, let's get this over with quick. Now, he refused to drink it. That's the point Matthew's making. The point that they're making here in Psalms is that he was given it. And the idea here is that he was also given that vinegar, which we know he did receive when he was on the cross, when he cried out, I thirst, and they gave him the vinegar at that point. And vinegar at that time, again, was something that they would oftentimes use as like a painkiller.
What would be in it, though? This vinegar, no painkiller.
Well, this science has evolved on what's effective in those things.
The gallery stuff is more than just vinegar.
I think so.
Do you have any idea what gall would
Abraham has it that way.
They were trying to kill him. Why didn't just break his leg? Because that was allowable by custom.
Well, again, it was allowable at a certain point.
Yeah.
The idea is
before
just that. Yeah. It would be before they came by to break the legs. And the only reason they broke the legs was because the Sabbath was high.
Yeah.
You know, so... Yes?
Is there any insight from the origin of the word Gaul? Is it an Old English word, a Latin word, a Greek word?
You know, I'm not sure on that, Redmond. I'd have to go back and look at that word.
Yeah, minor point, but just curious.
Yeah, I'd have to really look at it. Not sure. Good question. Yeah, we can find it for you. But I think the whole point is that he's looking at this, and he's describing here a death that's not pleasant, where he's looked at as an enemy of the nation. And he's rejected by the nation and by his family. Going down a little bit further, just read some of the things he says here back in Psalm 69. He talks about verse 26, "For whom thou thyself hast smitten, they pursue, and unto the pain of thy wounded ones they needs add. Lay punishment on their iniquity, and let them not enter into thy righteousness. Let them be blotted out of the book of life." That's an interesting thing, because that's a reference to the book of life, the earliest one. "And with the righteous, let them not be enrolled. I then am humbled and in pain." I think what he's trying to describe is the agony that's engulfing him as he's being put to the most horrific death devised. I mean, to be tortured to death is not a pleasant thing. The psalmist is vividly describing that process. And then we know, and I'm not going to go into the gospel accounts to look at it, because I think we've really been in those things a lot and we're familiar with those accounts. But Pilate himself found no cause of death in Jesus. Remember, he washes his hands and says, "I wash my hands of this innocent blood," and then they cry out, "His blood be upon our head," inadvertently accepting the sacrifice for a year, which is kind of an interesting scenario in of itself. But the whole point back in Acts 13 is that even though they didn't understand the prophecies that the prophets made, those things became true. Psalm 22 is another one that you could go to. Psalm 18 is another one. Isaiah 53 would be another one. And all of those passages talk about, you know, the suffering servant who's Messiah, and how he would suffer, and how he would bear reproach and shame for the nation, and how eventually he would be rewarded according to his own righteousness. And, you know, those passages really talk about that in detail. So that's what Paul's getting at here in Acts 13. Now, he says in Acts 13, verse 29, "And when they had carried out everything which had been written about him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb." Now, this really is a reference here to Deuteronomy 21. Somebody could take that. Deuteronomy 21 and verse 23. Deuteronomy 21, verse 23.
"His body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but you shall in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged is accursed of God."
Okay, now, What he's saying is they carried out everything written about him and they took him down from the cross and laid him in the tomb. If we remember, in particular, John's account, they were in a hurry to get him down from the tree or cross because the Sabbath was nigh and they didn't want to be defiled and so on. And they rushed. That's why he was buried in Joseph Arimathea's tomb. You know, and they really didn't have the correct burial procedures per se, because it was a rush job. The whole point, though, is that was done in fulfillment of what Moses had written. And that's what Paul is alluding to there. It's also alluded to back in Acts 5, if you want to go there. In verse 30.
The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom he slew and hanged on a tree.
Okay, the idea that he was hung on a tree. Again, that's in fulfillment of Deuteronomy 21. So you have these references. Acts 10 also makes a reference to it. We're not going to look at that passage, but Acts 10:39, just so you get the verse, makes a reference to Deuteronomy 21 in that regard, too. They took him down and put him in the tomb. Now, it's interesting. Not only did they take him down and put him in the tomb, but it says here in verse 30 of Acts 13, Elohim raised him from the dead. For many days, he was seen by those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now his witnesses to the people. We are telling you the evangel, what Elohim promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us, their descendants, by raising Jesus. And I want to stop there. He shifts from the death of Jesus, glances at and talks about him being placed in the tomb, and then is now talking about the resurrection. And he brings up this idea in verse 31. He was seen by those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. It would be the 12 apostles, or the 11 apostles, Judas being dead,
plus the whole crowd that would have been assembled in that room.
But in particular, it's a reference to the apostles in particular. And he says they, meaning the 11, are now his witnesses to the people.
Of all the people that came out of that grave when he was raised.
Right. Now, and there were, and they also witnessed of it. The other thing that's interesting, though, is the phrase to the people. The witnesses to the people. In Scripture, the people almost always is Israel. And the Gentiles aren't in view. And in fact, Paul is almost saying that when he says what Elohim promised our ancestors. Although he's speaking to an audience that has Gentiles present, he's really speaking to the Jews in the audience. It is his audience, really, first and foremost. Now, as he's speaking to them, he appeals to the witnesses who are proclaiming that Jesus has been raised from the dead. And those witnesses in particular that he appeals to are the 12. There are those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. It's the 12. Now, this is a pretty significant thing because he's saying that they're physical witnesses. Not only are they physical witnesses, but this will be the fifth time that Luke has used them in this context, that they witnessed the resurrection of Christ in the book of Acts. The fifth time. I want to give you the other passages. We'll look at them. Acts 2:32 is the first one. Acts 2, verse 32. This is Peter speaking. This Jesus is Elohim raised up, of which we all are witnesses. Now the all there is the 12. And Peter is saying, we're witnesses of his resurrection. It's the first time he does it. The next time is chapter 3. And verse 15. Somebody like to read that.
And kill the Prince of Life whom God has raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses.
Okay. That's the second time. Again, that was Peter speaking. But he's saying, we're witnesses of this. The we being the other 11 and himself. The next time would be Acts 5, verse 32.
And we are the witnesses of these things, and so is also the Holy Ghost, whom God has given to them that obey him.
Okay, so again, you have another witness. Then the next one would be Peter proclaiming to Cornelius in Acts 10. Let's go to Acts 10. Acts 10 and verses 39 through 41. And we are his witnesses as to whatever he did in all the region of Judea and in Jerusalem. The same person the Jews assassinated, hanging him on a tree. But Elohim raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all the people, but to us, who were chosen by Elohim, to be witnesses, and who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. And then the last time, the fifth time, is where we are in Acts 13. Now, five times is a significant thing because five is the number in Scripture of what? Grace. What Paul is getting at here is that even though you've killed your Messiah and participated in his murder, God is still willing to fulfill all of the promises he made to our ancestors and follow through with everything he has ever promised to give this nation. He says in verse 1333, he has fulfilled for us. Well, verse 32, we are telling you the evangel, what Elohim promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us, their descendants, by raising Jesus. Now, it's interesting. He's coming in and he says, everything that he has ever promised to our fathers, he is fulfilling because he raised up Jesus. In other words, Jesus is the fulfillment of every promise to the nation. But he goes on, and he then says, as it is written in the second Psalm, you are my son, this day have by begotten you. Now, I think this is really interesting that he quotes Psalm 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're going to look at this idea of begotten in a minute. What is the second Psalm about?
Why did the nations rage?
Right.
Why do they make plans of vain?
Right. It's talking about the nations allied against Israel, right? And how God is going to do a great work through the Messiah. Let's call this Psalm 2 for a second. Psalm chapter 2. Nations assembled in tumult, or should people mutter an empty thing? Now it's interesting, he has here a contrast between nations and people. The people would be who?
Israel.
Israel and the Gentile nations. The people, Israel, mutter empty things, or vain. I think it's the way the King James renders it, right? He says, the kings of earth take their station and gave men, and grave men have met by appointment together against Yahweh and against his anointed one, saying, let us break asunder their cords and cast from us their cords. He that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. My Lord will mock at them. Then will he speak unto them in his anger, and in his wrath confound them. Yet I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Now I want to stop there. The idea here is that the people and the nations conspire to eliminate Yahweh's anointed. Context of Psalm 2.
Not just Israel, but
the nations both together. Now, if we look at the crucifixion.
Not just eradicate Israel, but the promises can't be fulfilled, but they're going right after the Messiah himself.
That's right.
And Israel's just in the way.
Right. But Israel helps them.
Yeah.
That's the point. And even the point in Psalm 2. The people are doing vain. They're, you know, They're muttering empty things. They're in accord with the nations is the idea, right? And they've gotten together by appointment together against Yahweh and against his anointed one. Now, that could also be gotten together against Yahweh and against his Messiah. That would be a correct rendering. Or against his anointable one would actually probably even be maybe a little more accurate rendering. Let us break asunder their bonds and cast from us their cords. In other words, the nations in Israel are looking at it as if they're in bondage to Yahweh and is anointed. Let us break asunder their bonds and cast from us their cords. Then it says, he that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. My Lord, that would be Adonai, will mock at them. Then will he speak unto them in his anger, and in his wrath confound them. Yet I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Then it goes on, let me tell of a decree. Yahweh hath said unto me, my son thou art.
I today have begotten thee. Ask of me and let me give. Nations is thine inheritance, and it is thy possession the ends of the earth. And I want to stop there because this is the verse that Paul quoted. Right? He quoted Psalm 2:7. Now, in the context of Psalm 2:7, it is Yahweh appointing his son as the leader of his people. He says in verse 9, thou shalt shepherd them with a scepter of iron. As a potter's vessel shalt thou dash them in pieces. In other words, Psalm 2 is about the rejection of the Messiah, and after his rejection, God's placing him into a position of rulership over all those who rejected him. Now, this is going to give us insight on why Paul quotes here Psalm 2. Back in Acts 13:33, he has fulfilled for us their descendants by raising Jesus, as it is written in the second Psalm, you are my son, this day have I begotten you. In other words, when Jesus rose from the dead, he is being placed into a position of authority. His kingship has begun. His rulership has now been begotten or given birth to. And that's the sense I think Paul is using this. He began this address looking at the preparation of the Messiah and how that the Messiah had to come from the seed of David because the Messiah was going to be a successor to the throne of David. He now is culminating this section, speaking about death, burial, and resurrection, with Messiah being raised from the dead, being begotten by the Father, as the one who's the successor to the throne of David. And to confirm that, he will use a number of different references to show how this is true. For instance, Paul's going to quote out of in verse 34, for instance, verse 34, he quotes out of what passage? Elohim raised him from the dead, never to experience decay.
55 or 6, is that?
Okay. And really what he's getting at there is the Messiah, if you go to Isaiah 55, let's go there. Okay, Isaiah 55. In verse 3. Okay. Hearken that your soul may live, that I may solemnize for you a covenant age abiding, the loving kindness to David well assured. The idea here, and you have to take 55 in the context of 53, 54, and 55, yeah, to say flow, is that he lives. He died in 53. He's alive in 55. Incline your ear and come unto me. Hearken that your soul may live. That I may solemnize for you a covenant age abiding. the loving kindness to David while assured. What's that covenant to David? The Sage Abiding? The Davidic covenant.
Right.
Right?
The Erechus would be on the throne.
The idea is that it's the one who was prophesied about back in chapter 53. It really forms a trilogy, those passages. The point she's getting at it here is that he's not going to experience decay. But the promises are made to David. It's the quotation from Isaiah. The promises were made to David. Am a solemnized for you a covenant age abiding the loving kindness to David. In other words, the idea was that this covenant had been given to David. And it was to extend from David back further out. And what he's looking at here is that these promises made to David are now having its fulfillment in Jesus. Then he's going to quote Psalm 16:10 in verse 35. He alluded to it in verse 34. Therefore, he says in another psalm, you will not permit your Holy One to experience decay. In other words, he's using three different witnesses. He calls up the promises to David in particular, the covenant to David. He calls up Psalm 2. He calls up Psalm 16. And he says, all of these things are coming to fruition so that you can understand all these promises that have been given to our fathers are true in Jesus himself. Now, I think this is a pretty miraculous passage, really. He talks about, you know, the idea that all of this has come to pass. And then he talks on why it couldn't be fulfilled in David and why it wasn't a reference to David in verse 36. Why? Because David saw decay.
Right. The sepulchre was with him to that day.
Yeah.
The bones are in there.
Yep, he truly died. Right? Then in verse 38, he goes on, then let it be known to you, men, brothers, and through this one being Jesus, remission of sin is announced to you. And by him, everyone who believes is declared righteous from all things from which you could not be declared righteous by the law of Moses. Now, I think this is an interesting choice of words.
Mm-hmm.
Paul is saying here that you could not be declared righteous by the law of Moses. That it took someone to come on your behalf and to do for you what you could not do for yourself. Right?
Yeah.
He's saying remission of sin is announced to you.
And you said specific words. The word remission?
The word remission.
Yeah.
Is what is to remit something, what is that?
We've struggled with this before.
To send it in. Yeah. Remit your...
Make your remittance.
Right, you make your remittance.
You've already made your remittance.
Right, to be sent in, something has been sent in. So follow the idea. This one, through this one, remission of sin is announced to you. In other words, the payment for sin has already come. He's remitted it already.
We're going to get into far more depth, though, in Hebrews, where it talks about remission of sin versus full forgiveness of sin.
It does.
Like, we're Paul's going to talk about that in Ephesians 4:32. Forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. Now, is that different, or is that exactly the same thing?
It's different. Okay. On our website, there's a really good article. Well, I shouldn't say, there's good notes on that under the notes section. It,
beacon-ministries.org. Go to notes, click on that, and there's a one that talks about, I think it's remission or forgiveness.
Did
I think
you have any of that in your...
No, I don't. I unfortunately didn't have enough space to put all that in there.
How many pages is it?
It's study notes. It's an outline. Study.
Is it remission and forgiveness?
It gives a definition of them and everything, and it goes through different passages dealing with each topic.
Yeah.
The whole point, though, is forgiveness and remission. Remission is a payment.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, the payment is good if it's applied to an account.
Yes. Okay.
That's why belief becomes important here.
Mm-hmm.
To get the forgiveness, there has to be the belief.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, everybody's sins have been paid for. That's why hell can't contain anyone, right? If you want to use that word. That's why eventually all men are saved, because the payment for them has already been made. The point that releases them from the debt is when they believe it and allow that to be placed to their account. Okay, two different ideas there.
Sure.
This is the idea, though, that the account has been paid. You have to just apply it.
So then can you have forgiveness without remission?
No.
Okay, but you can have remission without forgiveness?
Yes. Kind of an interesting thing, right?
Yeah. The money is in your account, but you have not taken advantage of it yet.
Right. It's not been applied to you yet. It's there. It just hasn't been applied yet. Okay? Now, it's interesting because what happens at the end of all this, let me skip down a bit. Verse 40, beware then in case what is said in the prophet should come about. He's going to quote Habakkuk. How often do you get the book of Habakkuk quoted? Okay. It's going to be a quotation. I'm not going to go there, but it's a quotation of Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. Behold, you despisers, and marvel and perish, because I work a work in your days, a work which you would in no way believe if anyone declares it to you. Then it says, and as they went out, they begged that these words might be spoken to them between Sabbaths. Now, the people begging is the Jews who heard were begging Paul and Barnabas to continue speaking these things as they're leaving. Now, again, he's in the synagogue, he's proclaiming to the Jews, he's going to begin to teach them during the week that's going to follow. As he's proclaiming to them during that week, they're going to reject what he has to say. The Gentiles want to hear more of what he has to say, and Paul is going to, at that point, say, "Lo, return to the Gentiles." And that becomes a significant thing. So we'll pick up with that next week. This week, I want to end, his address in the synagogue is off to a good start. The Jews want to hear more of what he has to say. The majority, they're begging him.
But something happens where the heavy hitters come down. They get word of what's cooking.
Well,
and they want to mess
it up. Hasn't happened yet.
No.
Where we are.
Okay, yeah. But what goes wrong?
Paul has established some very important points, though. That everything is flowing according to prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about to take a rude interruption by the end of the chapter.
Not so bad by 44. You got the whole city coming up by 45. Oh, come on.
And then by the time you hit 47, Paul's turning to a different group of people. So... You know, I think this is a profound thing. That address really is a masterpiece of Paul. just laying out how God's program worked for Israel and what should have taken place and transpired. Jesus, when it says begotten there, he's talking about Christ being placed into a position to rule. That's what he's talking about there. He was begotten. It's not begotten in the sense that it would be used in Matthew 1. It's in the sense of Psalm 2. And it's what Paul quotes Psalm 2 there.
But the distinction being?
The distinction being one is begotten in the sense of physical birth.
Yes.
The other one is begotten in the sense of a position of authority he's being placed into.
Well, is he the first one from the dead?
He is the first one from the dead.
The yet all that we're talking about.
Well, again, it is that. But yeah. I think he's begotten from the dead to be that ruler.
Yeah, okay. Right, with that in view. But.
Right. But he is the first from the dead.
Yeah.
And that would be, and I didn't go there, but I'll give you a passage that you can jot down. Hebrews chapter 1. Verse 5.
The quote said, right?
Yeah. Hebrews 1, 5.
Yep.
And that's the sense of how begotten is used here.
Yeah.
He's begotten from the dead to assume his position of authority.
Yep. Prior to that, nobody was raised from the dead, never to see corruption again. Everybody else that was resuscitated
would eventually die again.
Die again. Lazarus.
But not Jesus. Jesus was raised from the dead, never to die. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Bill?
Yes?
I have kind of a general question about, mostly verses 38 and 39, where Paul talks about, through Jesus, but, you know, living on your members, that through this one Jesus, remission of sins announced by everyone who believes, declared righteous from all things from which you could not be declared righteous by the law of Moses.
Right.
I'm wondering, is it plausible to think here that Paul was having to be very meticulous in his presentation and his proof points because maybe he expected, maybe this passage that Luke's writing about here is showing that his audience wasn't really oriented to this outcome, not just because they either didn't know or didn't believe Jesus, but is it possible that their focus was really on being liberated from the physical, political, geographical rulership and oppression that they were under, as opposed to the oppression of their own bondage to sin?
I think so, because I think, again, the typical Jew of the day looked at the Messiah as a political liberator that would liberate them from Roman oppression. And they weren't really looking for him to be anything like what Jesus came as. They were looking at somebody that could start an insurrection and overthrow Rome.
Yeah. So even the concept of remission of sins to them sounds like it could potentially be a bit of a foreign concept and maybe even a bit of a slight, since they may not have considered themselves sinful, being the people of God.
Right. And I think that's part of the reason he's so meticulous on going through it the way he did. What he wants to do is he wants to make sure he's building an airtight case. In a sense, Paul's a great lawyer. You know? And you'll see him do this a lot in his writings, where what he'll do is he'll have a dialogue with himself. And that dialogue, oftentimes, he's anticipating the resistance that those that don't agree with him are going to have. And then he answers it. He does that a number of times in Scripture, where he'll bring something up, lay out a case, and then he brings up, well, what shall we say then? A phrase like that. And he asks a question.
And that question is anticipating what those who would not agree with him would say, and then he answers that. So it's almost like he lays out his case, anticipates the arguments to his case, and voices those arguments so that he can take that argument away systematically before it's ever voiced.
Yeah, it's a brilliant strategy. It also sounds like he is able thereby to, if at all possible, bring to them the absolute importance of them to be listening and hearing and abiding by his words, because he does talk about the consequences of not doing so.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I think Paul was a brilliant mind. Let's be honest. And I think he had that rare ability, and that might be part of the reason why the Lord chose him for this task. Is he had that ability to do things like that.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, it is amazing. He definitely was the right man at the right time. You know.
Unequaled.
Oh, yeah. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, well, that's a good stop point. Next week.
Thursday.
Thursday good for everybody?
I'm taking the whole month off, so I'm a bill.
Okay, good for you.
Thursday, huh?
Thursday.
I'll let you guys know. I'm not sure. It shouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what they're scheduling me or anything, so.
Okay. So we'll figure Thursday then, and then if it changes, I can let everybody know. Okay? Well, let's see. Redmond, would you like to close us?